From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Russia's foreign ministry sharply criticized Washington's claims that Syria's government planned a chemical attack in that country. This was foreign ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova in Moscow Friday.
The U.S. officials refused to confirm the claims with any facts. The situation looks like a massive provocation, both military and informational.
And Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov himself expressed concern that terrorists would take advantage of the language coming from Washington to carry out false flag attacks encouraging U.S. military action.
I look at the U.S. experts, and they say openly that extremists could use these claims by Washington, make provocations, and shift blame onto the Syrian government.
At Thursday's State Department press briefing in Washington, RT's Caleb Maupin asked Heather Nauert, a spokesperson for the State Department, about the concerns raised by Lavrov.
Recent statement from the White House alleging that the Syrian government was planning an upcoming chemical attack. Are you concerned that that could have created an opening for terrorist groups to carry out a chemical attack?
No.
You're not concerned, even though al-Nusra, al-Qaeda groups have been using chemical weapons in Syria? That's documented?
No. Next question on Syria.
Well, for more on all that, we spoke with our regular contributor from Moscow, Mark Sloboda, an analyst and senior lecturer at Moscow State University, who was also a retired U.S. naval officer. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Friday.
Let's start with this: the headlines out of the United States. Because there was a supposed leak, I assume this is a U.S. leak, from the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons in the last 24 hours, which purports to show that the OPCW had a finding that supports the U.S. accusations of a chemical attack several months ago on Ken Shaikun, which even the neocon think tanks such as the Washington Institute have identified in their own literature as a al-Qaeda stronghold.
Okay.
vice territory that had mixed al-Qaeda and U.S.-backed opposition and so on. They referred to Ken Shaikun, the place where the supposed chemical weapons strike hit, as a al-Qaeda stronghold.
Right.
There's several problems with this whole story. One, of course, it is from an anonymous, almost certainly U.S. leak. I mean, intentional leak.
Right.
It's not from the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. The Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons actually has no mandate to even make such a determination.
Right.
There was no on-site inspection. And they said quite clearly there will be no on-site inspection
right.
of Khan Shaikun, obviously because it's an al-Qaeda stronghold and there's no way of getting anyone in.
We can get him in.
Or any other international organization or anyone in there to do anything.
Well, you can send them in and they come out in two pieces. That's the problem.
And the U.S. blocked, the U.S. and the West blocked any on-site inspection of the airbase
right.
that they attacked. That supposedly, according to their narrative, the Syrian government launched a chemical weapons strike from. Because if it did, there would be residual traces of sarin there. You can't hide stuff like that.
Yeah.
Even up to a couple months afterwards, and paint residue and others, this would be around. And there were supposedly witnesses and samples provided to the OPCW, which came from Al Qaeda, to the White Helmets, to Turkey, to the OPCW, which is absolutely
right.
a zero chain of custody.
Exactly.
I mean, you're talking forensics, both in scientific analysis and in terms of criminal justice. There is no chain of custody.
It's a relay race.
There's
it's
no
ridiculous.
Evidence,
yeah,
right?
It's ridiculous.
You know, they're, none of this has any validity. They don't know where it came from. They don't know who these people are. It's just like these video.
Right.
The entirety of any evidence comes from videos and witnesses, uploaded or given to the public via Al-Qaeda. Right. There's simply no credibility there without an actual objective UN or affiliated team on hand to do inspection. So this is a non-story. The U.S. made some belligerent threats coming directly out of a White House statement, a press statement, that that they had indications that Syria was planning another chemical weapon strike, possibly even against U.S. Proxies in East Syria this time, and that would be a heavy price to pay if Assad carries this out. Right. Of course, our circles of people immediately jumped to the alarm. One, that this was a prelude to a greater U.S. escalation, or that the Al-Qaeda and friends, Zahar al-Sham, what have you, the 31 flavors of jihad in Syria, would use this, as a basic call to launch a chemical weapons in order to trigger a U.S. response on the Syrian government. Yeah. That's probably happened, more than a half a dozen times already over the course of this conflict. So Russia immediately reacted to this very angrily, saying there was no evidence. And supposedly, there was no official version of the U.S. evidence. There was no intelligence report released or anything like that. But again, through the usual anonymous leaks and sources, we have talks about a airplane used in it was put into a hangar on the same single airfield where supposedly the strike several months ago was. It's non-evidence, right. and nothing was officially presented, as is normally the case with these things. Then several days after, and nothing happens. There's no chemical attack. There's no U.S. strike or escalation visible. And Mad Dog Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, comes out and says the fact that there was no chemical weapons attack proves that there was an intention to have a chemical weapons attack, and our warning prevented the Syrian government from doing it.
I think they had to burn some kind of incense at the feet of a wooden god figure somewhere too to get there, because that's the most ridiculous. And you're right about, when you announce this is what's going to happen because we know about this strike. I mean, basically, the guys at Al-Qaeda are like, boys, the queue, we got the queue. Well, we're up next. And assume that it's time for them to strike.
So if something didn't happen, it's obviously evidence that there was a plan, and thank God we said something that averted it. This was repeated, stenography by the Western press, the establishment press, Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, etc., without a single hint of criticality of this logic. And which is really shameless. It's absolutely shameless. It's stenography. They're not doing journalism, and I'm not that I'm a journalist. I actually don't have a lot of respect for them as a class. present company excluded. But
I say it's a good thing we don't know any.
This is it's shameful. It would be laughable if it wasn't so very tragic. So there were several. All of this smoke and continued smoke aside, there were several significant pieces of information presented and argued that in the last week that you should read. The first that initiated the whole thing is Seymour Hersh, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who was, of course, has been involved in writing about the Syrian conflict from the very beginning, and goes back decades of work challenging establishment military narratives with his excellent work, and has been demonized in the past decade plus for challenging the narrative on Iraq and now on Syria from the beginning. He came out with an explosive piece in the German media outlet Welt. He published it here because the London Review of Books officially turned it down, in their own words, because they were afraid of being demonized in the current political climate.
Whoa. That sounds like why MSNBC fired
Phil Donahue back in the day around the Iraq war time.
This is neo-McCarthyite hysteria where journalists can't get their work published because it challenges, you know, establishment tropes and narratives. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's a really dangerous climate. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he got this published in a German piece. It's in English, of course. Everyone should read this. It's called Trump's Red Line. It's on Welt. And if you just simply type in Seymour Hersh and Red Line or Trump or something, you will immediately get it. And he spoke to anonymous sources in the intelligence community, which he says were senior DOD and CIA officials, who provided him with some details that the U.S. knew there was never chemical weapons strike, that Trump launched the attacks anyway, most likely for domestic political reasons, and the whole thing was a fabrication. This was immediately retorted by Bellingcat, by Elliot Higgins, this uneducated former World of Warcraft grandmaster and lingerie salesman without even a bachelor's degree, who is presented by the Western media, funded by the Atlantic Council and thus the Western governments, whenever they want to hand out proof, evidence, arguments on these incidents, they pull Elliot Higgins and Bellingcat out of their butt, and they shame themselves by presenting them as any sort of credible experts on anything. These digital sleuths who use completely selective and hoaxable digital media sources, stuff uplifted to YouTube to make arguments. Right. They have no expertise in any type of military or battlefield forensics, nothing to do with chemical weapons, nothing to do with shell ballistics.
It's propaganda.
No military experience, no relevant skills, qualifications, credentials whatsoever. But they have a retort to Seymour Hersh's. I suggest for the purposes of hearing all sides of the story, you read that as well. It's called Fooled Again. And then read in the American Conservative Scott Ritter's piece, which is basically a reply from Hersh, whom he worked with. Scott Ritter is the former Marine and chemical weapons inspector, chemical weapons and weapons of mass destruction inspector, who was demonized for coming out during the Iraq war for saying that there were no any actual weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which he proved to be correct on despite being demonized at the time. And he is actually, an expert on such matters. And myself, being a former U.S. Naval nuclear reactor operator, nuclear engineering, I have basic chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear training. Scott Ritter is someone who would have even more, having served as an actual inspector, he served in the military, U.S. military, and then on a U.N. Weapons of Mass Destruction inspection team. And he knows what he's talking about. Right. And he presents both sides of the story in a very objective way, so you can decide for yourself. And that is in a piece in the American Conservative. And may I give a plug? It's really strange for us leftists when we're talking foreign affairs events now that particularly challenging U.S. hegemonic operations around the world. Right. That the single best source for discussing these things has become the American Conservative. And why are we as leftists? I mean, Gareth Porter had a piece published there, recently and so on. Why are it's a question. It's a failure of establishment left media, I think, and in some cases, even the alternative left media, that serious discussions of foreign policy, foreign affairs, international events from a non-interventionist, realist perspective have to be dealt with in the American Conservative. If you're not reading it, another one is Sharmeen Narwani.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
She was published there. They have been a tour de force. You know, the National Interest also occasionally has pieces. And, you know, I mean, they aren't completely devoid, you know, in the left. Counterpunch gets the occasional piece. But if you're looking for serious discussions from a non-interventionist perspective, critical of U.S. foreign policy, you have to read the American, even from a leftist perspective, you have to read the American Conservative and to a lesser extent, the National Interest and perhaps sometimes War on the Rocks, because that's where such discussions, that's where such things are being published.
And they hired you into the PR department how long ago? You're doing really? No.
Yeah. You know, I have not yet submitted anything for submission there.
Here.
I do most of my work on televised media. But I've seriously considered it. I'm a big fan. There's no question about that. And if they now want to provide some income my way for my showing for them, I'm certainly opposed to it.
Okay, and that is only a joke, folks. All right, anyway, so let's go back. So Syria, you have this whole game going on around this, you know, game that played, you know, this little game that went last week that could have gone this way
piece,
or that way.
Go ahead. One more piece. Four pieces: Seymour Hersh, Bellingcat's reply, Scott Ritter's reply in the American Conservative, and then Jonathan Cook, Palestinian-based journalist who's also quite famous in the leftist anti-war perspective. His discussion of how Hersh's revolutions have been buried and demonized in the Western media. You know, how you can ignore something, from someone of Seymour Hersh's standard because it goes against the establishment view, and how it's buried by the corporate mainstream media today. So, you know, that's Hersh's new Syria revelations buried from view, and that's Jonathan Cook. Those are your four pieces to get a balanced all-around view of his stories with chemical weapons this week. And I think if any, you don't listen to me, you know, read the things
and make a
judgment for yourself.
Right. I mean, I'm looking now that actually Jonathan Cook's blog was updated again about a couple hours ago, and he follows on that. This one is called Media's Propaganda War on Syria in Full Flow, and it starts out referencing Hersh's piece again.
So it all definitely things worth reading. You know, you read what they say, you read what the left and now the conservative anti-interventionist media says, and you will get a view. So that is on the chemical weapons front, the big political. But there are also developments in Syria on the ground. First of all, Israel has been bombing in southern Syria at least five times in the last 5 days. Of course, every strike they make in Syria is an attack, an act of war on a sovereign government. They have no right to be doing so. They're still occupying the Golan Heights, where this is all going around. And all of these incidences are signature at this point. The Syrian army and its allies are fighting al-Qaeda, quite literally, again, al-Qaeda and its associated friends. They're now operating under the acronym HTS in southern Syria. The al-Qaeda then lobs a mortar or two at no directed target across the border into the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights deserts. This is the signal. That gives the Israeli defense forces the excuse they need to provide close air support to al-Qaeda. Oh, the conflict spilled over into our borders. We respond by attacking the Syrian army. This has become the rule. It has happened so many times now, it's not mistakable. Israel's air force is acting as the close air support for al-Qaeda in southern Syria. There's no question about it. Israel has even pushed, it's been appeared in the Israeli media several times before, but in the past few weeks, Israel has even been pushing stories where they admit that they have helped the rebels in southern Syria much more than has been publicly known, which includes treating ISIS and al-Qaeda members in their hospitals, also weapons, supplies, training, and so on. So this is all increasing. And it to me, it indicates that Israel, if they're pushing these stories on their own, that they want it publicly known because they intend to get more involved in southern Syria. Yeah. And their excuse is that Hezbollah, who is allied with the Syrian government fighting the Wahhabist jihadis in Syria, cannot have a presence. They cannot allow a Hezbollah presence in southern Syria. So they use that as a justification for attacking Syrian government forces. The other big thing is that Erdogan, Turkey, is flooding troops and tanks into the occupied area of north central Syria above Aleppo that he invaded and occupied with his Operation Euphrates Shield. And all indications and statements are that he intends an attack on the Syrian Kurds to the west of this area. This is centered around Afrin. These are, you know, the Syrian Kurds, again, are not a monolith. Some are more supported by the United States. That would be the Syrian Democratic Forces in the east of Syria. But the Afrin canton is more supported by the Syrian government and particularly by Russian forces. And so this is seen as a direct challenge. The Kurds across the border are very upset. They see this slow motion coming, expected within the next couple of days. Russia evidently has troops, advisors, special forces advisors on the ground with the Kurds. America is also moving more experts and advisors in the east among its own Kurds to try to prevent, again, any Turkish land grab, any further Turkish land grab in northern Syria. But Erdogan is not out of this game yet. The third most significant event, again, this is not completely confirmed. There are multiple sources saying that in the U.S. military base in southeast Syria at Al-Tanf on the border, this three-way border between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, where the U.S. has been trying and failing to train up a moderate Sunni proxy force for the umpteenth time. This base, as we talked about a few in the last couple weeks, was basically cut off and blocked off from any advance north into Syria to meet up with the SDF or anyone else to make a move on Deir ez-Zor for any potential partition of East Syria. They were blocked off by kind of a Hail Mary move by the Syrian army to basically surround them, reach the Iraqi border where they are cooperating with Iraqi Shia militia groups. They have completely cut off this base from the rest of Syria. So the U.S. has the option of either with its handful of proxies of trying to fight through the Syrian government, Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and everyone else, or just accepting, you know, the game's rules as they are, that they took this territory force, so they get it, and sitting down there in this base, without being able to do anything, and they're blocked from the war of maneuver. In that area, at least. So there have been repeated rumors, lots of reports that the U.S. is removing its proxies from this base. They're going to airlift them to Kurdish-held territory, and it must be said they're no friends of the Kurds, and the Kurds don't much like them. Al-Shadadad in northeast Syria, in the Kurdish-held areas, where they might be of some use up there, fighting ISIS or possibly again moves against the Syrian government or whatever, but they will not be a threat in southeast Syria. It seems likely that that is the only move the U.S. has, short of now going to overt war with Syria, Russia, and Iran in that corner of Syria. So they've lost that, and it seems to be that they are accepting that they've lost that war of maneuver. And it looks increasingly like there is no possibility for partition. They've simply run out of options. The Kurds are not a viable partner, and the neocons are extremely upset about this because they've really been pushing this option for the last 2 weeks that partition has to be done. You can read it by Horowitz and the Daily Beast, and John Bolton was trotted out to make statements to this effect, that they have to stop Iranian influence in East Syria, and the only way to do this is for the U.S. to take control of this territory. Well, that option seems to have run out. They've been strategically outplayed by the Syrians and the Russians, and they're not yet willing to escalate to overt war with Syria and Russia a plan which there really are no good options, because mm-hmm. there is no native indigenous Sunni moderate proxy force for them to use.
Yeah, no, and the institutions that existed that held, that apparatus, technocrats, et cetera, exactly as needed and relatively neutral in the political and religious sect spheres, that was destroyed. And now you've got all this stuff in motion, in this kind of motion, like eating itself.
I mean, it's a story wherever the U.S. has interfered, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen. Have you taken a look at a map recently of which factions control what in Libya? It's a madhouse patchwork of insanity. That was NATO's big mission accomplishment, to support the ideology of R2P and foreign intervention. I mean, wow.
Tripoli was such a great hang. Okay, in 2000, when I was there in 2009. It was, you walk around, grab a bite to eat here, the window shopping there, talk to people here, watch somebody rolling a cigar on the street, out of these big tobacco, whatever. It was like a nice, cool hang, people friendly, everybody had a place to live, all that, no homelessness. And now it's like some dystopian movie that, John Carpenter or somebody dug up.
And yet, the arguments for U.S. intervention, quote unquote, as they call it, the neocons, right, the right. liberal humanitarian imperialists,
right.
they continue to make the same arguments after failing again and again and again, and they completely ignore the evidence of their own, failed, interventions. As Putin said, we need no lessons from those who destroy entire nations, lessons on democracy from those who destroy entire nations.
Yeah, absolutely true. And when they do that, they trot out, like yesterday at the United Nations, Kevin Kennedy, who's regional humanitarian coordinator for Syria at the UN, he had a press conference, and he's talking about all the horrible things that are going on the ground in a humanitarian way, and emphasized, according to the press release, the way it's presented, and they're blowing up hospitals, that this is particularly egregious. Now, it is egregious, but I don't see it as being any more egregious than, well, you blew up this whole neighborhood and killed everybody that lived in it. It's on par, I think.
The difference is when the U.S., as it has done in Afghanistan, as it has done in Mosul and Fallujah, when it blows up hospitals, they're occupied by the jihadis they're fighting, and right. it's okay. It's no big deal.
Right.
When Russia or the Syrian government attacks hospitals or schools or government buildings that have likewise been seized by al-Qaeda or right. other jihadis or ISIS or whoever, that's definitive targeting of civilians.
I use this same metaphor with Margaret Kimberly yesterday, but it's like in Walking Dead, when Michonne would put on a dead zombie skin or something in front of her, and the zombies all thought she's now a zombie and she could walk through them. It's kind of like putting on that kind of clothing.
A lot of people, of course, the liberal media suddenly started paying attention, somewhat attention, to U.S. casualties in the fight against ISIS in Mosul and Iraq, in Raqqa, and to a lesser extent, casualties of the U.S.-Saudi war in Yemen, simply because Trump is in charge of it now rather than Obama.
Right.
They started paying attention to the casualties. And you will not hear me complaining about U.S. casualties fighting entrenched jihadis in ISIS in Mosul or Raqqa right. or anywhere, because I'm right. a military man and I know that casualties happen when you're fighting jihadis right. entrenched right. in urban warfare. Urban warfare is very difficult, and airstrikes are used, artillery is used, and civilian casualties occur because right. they're effectively using the civilian population as a pool, as human shields. Yeah. It's very literal. And again, when Syria or Russia, the Syrian government or Russia, causes civilian casualties, collateral damage, as the U.S. calls it. It's deliberate targeting. But when the U.S. it's because the jihadis they're fighting were using human shields. Right. So, there's a complete double standard in the reporting and the narrative and the way the media reports and the government talks about such things as propaganda points.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.